I am Helene Meisler, columnist at Real Money. And I'm panicked that Howard won't wish me a happy Valentine's Day today.
Hello, Howard.
Dude, love of my life. This is our first Valentine show.
I know.
Did you get me anything?
Yeah, sure. Got you some chocolate.
Ooh.
It's still at the store.
Still at the store. Still in the Amazon warehouse.
Yeah.
As they like to say. So what is up?
Not too much. We just finished with the Phoenix Open and the Super Bowl here in town.
It was crowded.
So finally, it's possible to drive on the roads again.
I had about 30 kids in my house.
Oh, my God.
And they left me with a mess and a fucking nasty head cold. I'm hurting over here.
Oh, my goodness.
Can you hear it?
Yeah, you're a little congested. Just drink some coffee.
I'm drinking a little coffee.
Bathing coffee.
And my wife, Ellen, you know her, our listener, she up and went to San Diego today. Can you imagine? I've been married, I don't know, 60, 70, 80 years at this point. The time stands still with Ellen. Timeless. And
she does look awesome.
Okay, keep your eyes off Ellen.
Ellen looks okay.
Keep your head out of the gutter. So she goes, I'm going to San Diego today. Valentine's Day. Can you imagine a guy? I wake up one day and I go, hey, hon, I'm just going to go see some friends in San Diego on Valentine's Day. That would go over well.
Yeah. Is it possible she mentioned it a few days ago and you forgot about it?
No, she did tell me, but it takes a lot of pressure off me.
Right.
As a guy who's run out of stuff to do with their wife 26 years ago on her wedding night, it's hard for a guy. You know, we're gropers. Speaking of groping, we have one move, grope. And once that move's played out 26 years later, she took the initiative this year to leave me on Valentine's Day. So she's in San Diego. We had a water problem, as they call it.
Yes.
Yeah. Not the typical water problem, which is me and my prostate. We had a water problem at the house.
Yes.
Our home. And so she's there with the designer. We need a new kitchen. We need, anyways. And so she's left me here alone on Valentine's Day. So we're having a chick, a lady, back on the show, Helene Meisler, who is the queen of price and sentiment and technical analysis. Very popular woman. And you'll know why. We've had her on in June of last year. She knows her stuff. She loves talking about the markets. She is a connoisseur of chart art. That's what I call it. They would call it technical analysis. Maybe dig into that. We need some branding overhaul. And living in St. Louis, because probably just one step ahead of the law. I don't know anybody who lives on St. Louis by choice. But we'll dig into that too, maybe, if she's willing to talk about it. And she is panicked. I overheard that I wouldn't say Happy Valentine's Day. So, well, panicked, because I have no intention of saying that, because everyone will listen to this and be upset that maybe I got something going on the side in St. Louis.
Right.
And I have a trip planned there for May, so two and two together. No, so Happy Valentine's Day, pre-Happy Valentine's Day to Helene Meisler. Last time she was here, June, we went through this hilarious groping for a bottom situation. Yeah, so and to be honest, there were two people now that I know that have called June a bottom. I don't think Helene was saying bottom, but we were talking about groping for a bottom. And we flash forward, where are we at? February? When is Valentine's Day? February?
Yeah, middle of February usually.
We flash forward 8 months, and that kinda was for many, at least for the equal weighted indexes, a good time to start buying stocks. Tech more October, November. Even December, I've had a rally. So what a great time to catch in and see if we have groped successfully or if there's further groping to be done. We're going to talk a little about tennis, a little about pickleball. Helene was over at the Australian Open. She loves tennis. Tennis is kind of, I wouldn't say under assault by pickleball, but I want to check in with a tennis lover how pickleball thanks, and then we'll talk about the markets and most importantly, what she is seeing and feeling about things going forward here in 2023. So you ready?
Yes.
Helene.
Good morning.
Good morning. Happy Valentine's Day.
Oh, Howard, thank you. And happy Valentine's Day to you, too.
Yeah, my wife left me on Valentine's Day. Now, it's a good move. It's a power move because I'm a very leavable person.
Well, no, you're not. But,
thank you.
You know, it's just another day. And
it really is. I know women don't like hearing that, but it's just another day. Every day with Howard is glorious, I like to tell my wife.
Every day with Howard is a bull market.
Yeah, she says more like inglorious bastards every time I say glorious. And so tell me, what made you, because looking back, and obviously we had you on because I think you're one of the best. We joked about it, but we were groping for a bottom in June. What would describe where we're at today in one technical term?
Still groping.
I agree.
I think there's still not nearly the kind of certainty everybody would like. Although, to me, once you have certainty, you're probably at the end of the move anyway. But, you know, think about how we were in September and October when everybody was certain that the bear market was going to continue forever.
I was, yeah.
Oh, okay. There you have it.
Well, I was bearish. I was like, my point at the end of the year, and this time I'm shocked that I've become, my word of the month has been constructive. Your word continues to be groping. But I remember at the end of last year, it wasn't that I was bearish. It was just like, how can we not believe that what we just saw in tech wasn't going to spread? And so flash forward 3 months, I am cautiously optimistic that it hasn't spread. It feels like my only concern about this market has been that now everybody's so confident that we're going to have a soft landing and that rates have kind of peaked out. That's kind of my bearish take right now, is everybody went, because we didn't crash and the contagion didn't spread, everybody's like, oh, maybe we're okay. And so when you say groping, what do you see?
Well, let me just take care of that part for a minute. You know, and I don't think we're in the same place, but I would like to say that in September of 2000, the S&P, I don't know if it made a new high or got right up to the old high. So, you know, I don't like when everybody sort of gets in that soft landing camp because it becomes way too complacent. And so my view in the last week or so has become since early February is that we've gotten a little complacent. I don't think we got giddy. I think we've gotten complacent in that, you know, stocks go up, stocks go up, stocks go up. Well, they don't always go up. And one of the things I've been thinking about a lot lately is that even if interest rates don't go down or, heck, don't go up, maybe they're just sort of stuck where they are for a while, you know, they're still sort of in a 4% range, let's call it. And I'm older than you, Howard, but for most of my career up until we got to this, you know, zero interest rate situation a decade or so ago, stocks didn't just go up and they didn't just go down. They upped and down, and even in the bull market of the 80s, they still upped and down. And to me, when I look back, I think, well, that's because interest rates weren't zero.
Yeah.
And if interest rates aren't zero, stocks can have an upward bias, but I think they're going to do it with an up and a down and an up and a down and an up and a down. And it's just hard for me to imagine that we're going to go back to a market such that we had in a zero interest rate environment where there is no alternative.
Yeah, I guess Japan broke the mold, and maybe we thought for a brief moment at the peak that America could just copy Japan. But alas, here we are. And I would say, seeing that we didn't copy Japan, I think the only thing I'm pretty confident of is that what we saw from 2010 through 2020 will never be seen again. Much like the first internet boom, prices will do weird things. Technology will come out of nowhere. Giddiness will reign for small periods of time. But what we saw in looking back, I just, it's so obvious, but I mean, so fun, so weird. But I don't think we're going to see that 0% interest rate again. That was an experiment that went too far.
I'm in agreement, and it stayed for too long.
Too long. It was an experiment that they knew was broken at the end, but kept it going.
Right. So, you know, so just my sense of it is that even if interest rates, let's just say bonds stabilize here, interest rates go down a little, they go back up a little. I sort of think interest rates are kind of in that area, that the stock market can go up, but it's going to do it with an up and down pattern if it does it. And right now, I think we're in sort of a, at best we could chop, and more likely we pull back.
So the way I see it with the 4%, and you're right, like I think I'd start getting concerned if we break out of this range, is there's just more competition for stocks, whether it be in bonds and real estate and treasuries. So that in itself is going to create the chop that we didn't have in 0% interest rate world. In the 0% interest rate world, what did happen is people got lulled, sucked into 10-year 0% bonds because they felt like if they're, that was the alternative, getting 0% versus taking risk on the spectrum. So everybody got beat up at the end because if you were in 0% rate bonds finally in 2020, saying, shit, that's my only diversification, I think that's what led to such a bad 2022. Everything didn't work.
Right. But, you know, I can't remember when it was, but didn't Apple come with some huge bond offering at like 1% and it got gobbled up?
Got gobbled up.
I think that was around 2020. I can't remember exactly.
When you look back, what was the thing where you wrote or thought to yourself, this is it, this is the top? When did you just like, I can't believe this has happened? Like, what was like a smack the forehead, this is the top kind of moment?
For me, it was absolutely that January, February period of 2021.
Did you act on it or you just knew and just
that
lightened
was the,
up?
The meme stocks and the options trading and Bitcoin. And I mean, I've probably said this a million times. NASDAQ had over 700 stocks making new highs. Come on, that's like ridiculous.
Interesting.
Just all that sort of gasping, you know, SPACs. I mean, it had it all. It
we had
literally
it all.
Had it all. And so, you know, to me, that's, you know, you take something off the table there.
Yeah, I think that the funny thing is the FANGs kind of hid it for another 8 months.
Oh, man, they hid for almost another year. Yeah.
Yeah. And so is it possible that this could be it? Like, my problem is when you have that many signs of a top, that if we just muddle along here, it would be one of the greatest gifts or lack of punishments of all time. Because the punishment has not fit, I wouldn't call it the crime, but has not fit the bull market.
Well, I think one of the things that we had in this market is that we have not just one, but a handful of very high market cap weighted stocks.
Mm-hmm.
And they tend to control the index. So if you look back, you know, NASDAQ had in January last year about 1,900 stocks making new lows. And then when you and I spoke again in May and June, again, 1,900 new lows. You didn't expand beyond that. And then when we came into September and October, the number of stocks making new lows was, I think it was not even quite 1,100. Maybe it was less than 1,000.
Right.
So in other words, what was taking the indexes down in September and October was FANG.
Right.
Or whatever you want to call it, those stocks that control the indexes.
Yep.
Okay. I mean, if you control 25% of the index, whatever you're doing is going to be what the index is doing.
Correct.
And so I think so many stocks had already seen, what, 70, 80, 90% downside by the time the spring and summer came along. That's why I said we were groping for a bottom, because so many were down already. What did you think? They were going to go down another 90%? I mean, I guess they can, but at some point they get sold out.
Right.
And so, you know, so I think we're in a period now where breath kind of started to get a little crummy in late January, early February. And so I think you're in a period now where really those big cap stocks are controlling the indexes. So when people plow into them, look at Microsoft yesterday, up what, 9?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't even know how many points that was, or, you know, without it, what the S&P would have done. But it's certainly a change,
right,
considering, you know, the other names were only up a little bit. So I think as long as you have people selling or buying those handful of stocks, that's what's going to control your index. And that's what's changed versus 20 years ago.
But the unwinding of that, it just feels like it shouldn't just take 6 months to a year. So that's where I'm going with the constructive, but like I'm not sold that, especially with if interest rates were zero, I'd probably be able to be sold a little easier. But with interest rates at 4 or 5%, I'm not sold that the worst is behind us.
Right. You know, I'll give you one other thing, though. Versus 20 years ago, there's more money in the stock market now.
Yeah.
You know, it's now become 20 years ago, I don't remember people, random people talking about their 401ks. And now, you know, even if, you know, if you just meet a random person, you can almost hear them talking about the stock market. I mean, it's very different than it was just even two decades ago.
Anecdotally, does that mean anything to you?
Well, it tells me there's complacency.
Yeah.
You know, all those boomers retiring every day are all counting that the market always comes back.
Yeah.
You know, here's just something to think about. And I don't know if this is where we are, but if you think about the market in the 60s and the 70s, you had the big 50%, you know, decline into the 1974 bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had a big rally, and everybody thinks we just lifted off from there. My God, from 1975 to 1982, we literally were in like a 20% trading range.
Interesting.
Up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down. And that was the market.
I feel so, we'd be getting away with a lot if we got that. And that's what I'm prepared for.
I can't say, you know, that we're going to go down a ton or going to go up a ton from here. I still feel like we're in a giant sideways. And even if we go to 4,300 from here, I would still feel that way. Or if we went to 3,200. So you just expanded the range a little bit.
Yeah.
From what I see, I just can't see that all of a sudden we're going into a multi-year up or a multi-year down.
Yeah. As a woman in the business, a woman who loves stocks and charting and talking about stocks and mixing it up, the mostly male audience, what is it about this that is not attractive to women? What are we doing wrong to get more women participating?
I think I grew up in a world where, you know, look, I went to work at Goldman Sachs. Maybe there were three professional women on the trading floor of, what, 300
right.
men.
Right.
But
it's probably higher than 1% now, but still under 10.
I have not been on a Goldman Sachs type trading floor in
a
long
just
time.
Based on interactions that you get online when you talk about stocks.
Yeah, I would say it's still majority men.
Yeah.
I don't know. I have always, because I get that question a lot, and more often than not, I get it from women.
Right.
And my answer is I don't give it a lot of thought because early in my career, I sort of made a decision. I'm going to do what I do, and either it's accepted or it's not accepted kind of thing. And there was a guy at Goldman who said to me once, I don't care if you're green, yellow, or blue. If you make me money, doesn't matter. And I thought, you know, he's so right. And that's kind of just how I've treated my whole career. So that's just where I am. If I had to guess, most women don't do it because it's you have to be a risk taker. And I would guess that too many are risk averse.
Hmm.
But that's a generalization.
It might be. So I come to you and I say, listen, last chance, Howie Town, we're coming to you. We got $3 million and build me something for women. Is there something you would say, Howard, there's no money in the world that I could do that? Is there, if someone said, just build me a financial platform for women, what do you think it would look like?
Oh, God, that's a good question. I would imagine that...
Do you have an idea where you would start? Would it just look different?
I think most women would require more interaction.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas most men are like, okay, you told me, I got it. I'm good to go.
Yeah. I'm out.
Right. I'm good. You gave me the three principles I need to know. I'm good. And, yeah. And most
Leave
women
me alone.
Would be. Most women might go home and look at those three principles and come back with five more questions.
So what I'm saying is, someone came to you at this point in your career and you had some free time. Is it a project that is in your mind worth pursuing?
Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't that what Sally Crawshaw is doing?
I will not correct you because I don't know, but I know she is, and it's doing so well that you're not quite sure. So I have not heard much. I know they've raised a lot of money, but it shouldn't be all about how much money you raise. Listen, when I held Robin Hood in my hand, or when the first time we saw E-Trade back in the day, whether it's the advertising or the colors or the UI, whatever it is, it attracts mail. But you know, the numbers are, and I've made some investments backing women in this space, the numbers are that 50% of women are CFOs of their house. So it's always just, you know, I don't know if I'm sabotaging my own portfolio or tricking myself into believing something else, or the numbers are wrong, but women should be investing.
They should.
And I can't figure it out for the life of me. So I thought maybe you'd have some insight.
But isn't the nature of a CFO to be more plodding and cautious than aggressive? Is it the chief marketing officer, the guy who's the aggressive guy?
Sure, but they still are handling the money, so it's not
They're
like,
handling the money, but they're handling it in a much more risk-averse way.
Yeah, but then you can still manage money and say, listen, we're going to go 100% bonds and we're going to ladder them. So anyways, it fascinates me. It sounds like you haven't spent that much time thinking about it. And even you're telling me women don't reach out that often to you, but they do, but not as often as a guy would reach out and say, teach me.
Yeah, I would say the majority of the questions I get would be from men.
Huh. And it bumps me up because this is a language that's a joyous language, and it shouldn't be a language that the majority of men just choose to speak. It's interesting to me. It's an open-ended question that I'm continuing to try and solve with some female founders, but I am not batting well in that category. And it really bothers me, so I may have to continue to pick your brain. I don't know. I think you should spend more time thinking about this, because there's a lot of male CFOs, too, and they're aggressive. So it could just be men are from
Mars.
And women are from Africa.
Venus. Venus.
Oh, Venus. All right. So switching topics here, you feel we're still groping. I think a lot does depend on interest rates. I also would say that the world is now different. Like valuation compression, I don't know if you go this deeply. My big beef with the whole world right now is, you know, you can be bullish or bearish, but you still, too much credit has been given to people by themselves, a lot in this case, because the market was the market. They failed to, you know, give credit to the macro that led to these great returns. And I don't think enough people realize how big a difference 4% will make on valuations. And forgetting how the market does or doesn't do, I look at some of these companies, and you can chart them till you're blue in the face, but I look at a company, and I apply this to Web 2 companies, Uber, Airbnb, the survivors, Robinhood, Coinbase, the ones that we know are going to be around. We don't know where they're going to be priced at, but we know that it would take some severe management destruction at this point to destroy these brands. And every time I get excited about the survivors, I look at the valuations and I go, Jesus, how do you do the math on this from a law of large numbers, forgetting the charts and everything? Does that ever something that you look at, or is it just purely price and volume?
I just look at price, but I do often use the example that after the dot-com bust, mm-hmm. even the stocks that were the darlings of the 2010s, the Amazon, the Apple, you know, Google, whatever, all those stocks mostly had upward bias in the 2000 to 2007 bull market, but they weren't great stocks.
Right.
The great stocks were the banks. The financials,
and the home builders, yeah,
the conglomerates, the home builders. I mean, they were, you know, think of GE back in leading up to 2000 or 2001. What did that stock do? I mean, it's a piece of crap, but think of that. What I mean, for like, in other words, forget, you know, if you want me to get away from Apple, think of the winners from that late 90s bull market And a lot of them, when you look back at a long-term chart, were just in trading ranges for years.
Mm-hmm.
And NVIDIA, darling NVIDIA, go take a look at a long-term stock chart of that. It was up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down. And, you know, with an upward bias, but it was a lot of up and down. It wasn't like, oh, I just got to own it. And so your Ubers of the world could just be in that sort of phase where they had their big run, they came down, and now they're going to have a long time of basing.
Yeah, I don't know about basing. I just, for my it's like Cisco when it was a trillion and then down to 100 billion, and it was just that law of large numbers. I look at Uber and I go, it doesn't care what the chart is, it's a $70 billion brand already. I try and look at it both contextually and from the price.
Okay. But sometimes, Howard, they grow into their valuation
sure.
by going sideways, don't they?
Yep, yep. I just think that's what we're faced at best. The companies I love the most that got me excited about Web 2, unfortunately, are just so fully valued that it's just, I can't watch them. And the action has moved on to elsewhere. I think that's what people are struggling with. It's, you know, we're staring at a price chart, but the price is just marking time because of these valuations. And so I think the biggest problem we have is this compression in valuations that will just put this lid on this market for the most part.
And so, you know, in many ways, that's a lot of what happened post-2001.
Correct.
And I know everybody is looking for the exact analogy, but you don't always have an exact analogy. You often have a variation of it.
Yes.
You know, history rhymes, it doesn't repeat.
Yep. The big one here is the 4%, the 0 to 4. It wasn't so much that we were at zero. People just started changing their models and life went on. It's this gigantic move to a new reality that now has to be factored in.
And that's what, oftentimes what a long digestion period is. I just told you, from 1975 to 1982, we up and down and up and down and up and down. And go back and take a look at what transpired in Apple from 2002 to, I don't remember, I want to say 2008 or 10 or something like that. I mean, it was a very wide trading range. It didn't start becoming a darling again until well after 2008.
And so what gets people through this is, I want to talk about next, is routine. Walk me through, because you've been through these cycles, you still love the market. You still, every time I talk to you or interact with you online or read what you say, you exude this joy of the game, the business, whatever we call this. Because for me, it's a joy. I don't mind staring at it and not making money. It's my way of checking in on the pulse of the world and how people feel. What does your routine look like today? And is it pretty much the same around markets that it was even when you were leading technical analysis at Goldman, other than just the pressure, meaning the same work process?
Yes. I mean, over the years, a few things have changed. Obviously, the markets have changed, right?
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, the process is pretty much the same thing I've always done. I start by going through my hand-drawn stock charts every night, and then I go through my statistics, and then, you know, it's just always, for me, it's the same routine. What I personally love about markets and why mm-hmm. I'm still interested after 4 decades of doing this mm-hmm. is because every single day brings something new and different.
Mm-hmm.
Even if my routine is the same, the market isn't always the same. There's always something new and different to be noticing and seeing and watching and focusing on or learning. When it comes to markets, I think there's no point where you can ever say, well, that's it, I've learned it all.
I agree. I don't know how to spread this. I look at Knut and he smiles because he knows that we appreciate talking about it, but no interest in the markets. Knut would be the first guy to say, Howard, handle it.
True.
Why is that? Why don't people understand that it's a language? Is it us not doing a good job explaining it?
Why are some people
why
artists
is not everybody?
And some people are engineers?
It's like speaking English. So why are people not engage more in the, it's because it's a language, you know, price, sentiment. This is still just a language that people learn to speak, a language that evolves and yet we can't seem to get people to teach it or to engage it at a young age. And I think it's a mistake, and I'm just wondering what are we doing wrong? Not, I talked about it earlier with you with women, but it's not just women. It's young kids. It's like, what are we doing wrong in engaging them in this opera and this language of it?
We should be teaching them when they're younger.
Yes.
There should be a financial course. I'm sorry, when you start like 7th or 8th grade, the same way you're learning Spanish or French or whatever, you should be learning, first of all, how to write a check, but you know what I mean? How to pay someone else money and how to balance a checkbook or that kind of thing. You know, that's basic knowledge that we should all have. And along with that, you would teach someone about the basics of the stock market and the bond market. Because I think if you wait until people are older, you've probably waited a little bit too long. And a lot of people, once they get older, they get married, they have kids, they've got so much else going on that they don't have time to start spending any time on this.
Yeah, I think what the 1990 or the 2000 bubble was better than this bubble, or created maybe more trauma. And again, I'm trying to like, everyone rhymes. So they completely agree with you. We're not anywhere. These are not the same, but yet they are so much the same, but so different here. And the way they're different, and I'm really nervous about this bear market because it's not maybe as vicious, but I feel it's going to trap a lot of people, is the E-Trade / Yahoo Finance / Yahoo message boards versus today's Reddit and GameStop was different in that people were getting a much bigger education in public markets versus this class has learned a lot of lessons or not learned a lot of lessons yet in the private markets, which is many more ways to hide pain and wounds versus the public markets where you have to look at your portfolio or not look at it and suffer the consequences of it in liquidity or fix it and move on versus the private markets, which seem to be the more the rage in this boom where a lot of the mistakes are still hiding and covered up. I think that's going to come back to really hurt us this time.
Yeah, but that's not your average retail investor is not in that.
Average, you're right. I mean, the average retail investor, like you said, started doing weekly options and thinking they had an edge on Reddit. But that was still very small slice versus the E-Trade, Daytech, Schwab days where the commercials were on all day. And it was like, you know, quit your job. Your boss was an idiot. Like, if you really think through those commercials in 99, it was very different than this one, which was more about, I'm going to get into the next Uber. And so I think there's a lot of hidden leverage and mistakes that aren't out in the open yet of this bear market versus the 1999 one. So as vicious as 99-2000 was because everybody was in the market, this one feels like everyone's in the market. They're just in stuff that's not quite public to the naked eye. So,
or you could say that, you know, the average person with money in the market just keeps buying their Vanguard spiders or whatever they're called.
That's quite possible. And
in other words, it's a different level of complacency and giddiness in that, well, the market always comes back. And so, you know, you can't time the market. That's one of my favorite things.
Yeah, no. Okay, so good. So on routine, what is it? Are there people or is it just your process? Is it price or is there certain people that do you open yourself up to new people or is there a group of people that you just must have read or is it all just the price and the data?
Oh, I definitely like to read. And sometimes I read new things and sometimes I read them and discard them pretty quickly. But mostly I just start, like I said, I do my charts, I do my statistics, and that's all me. I don't want any input from anybody else because otherwise I'm highly influenced. I know I am. And so mm-hmm. I sort of try and tune everybody else out while I'm working on my own work.
Mm-hmm.
And then I write my column and my newsletter because, again, I don't want to be influenced by other people telling me, you know, oh, the market only goes up. Oh, the market only goes down. I don't want that. Because if I respect your opinion, you're going to sway me.
Yep.
And I shouldn't be swayed. I should only use my statistics and my indicators.
Right.
But, you know, don't we all have somebody who we think is a great fade?
Yeah, the moosh. There's, I have on StockTwits, you know, it's impossible to share it. And I think that's the power of Twitter and Reddit and FinTwit and StockTwits is there's a group of about 100 people. God bless them. I hope they live till 100 that at certain times I can check in on them and go, oh, thank God they're still alive doing the wrong thing. So, yes, I think it's easier to pick mooshes than it is to pick legends. And
right.
So, yes, I do have my mooshes.
Legends usually have more money and more patience.
Yeah, like for me, Fred Wilson, a legend. I have to make up sentiment sometimes. You know, I was telling people because he doesn't write as much. But that's also a sign of, you know, forgetting that he's busy and maybe doesn't want to write as much. He doesn't want to take the flack. I always use it as a sign as like, you know, there's just not much to write about at the end of that boom. And then lately he's been writing a little more. And I know that's because he's, you know, my read into it, and I could be wrong, is that he's a little more optimistic based on the tone. So there's very few people that I read and try and infer from. And then this boom cut out a few people that I thought, you know, I've had to curate my list down with the end of this boom, as I'm sure some people have cut me out. But I had to cut my list down because, hey, you know, you kind of lost me. And so I think it's up to us to continually curate. You must continually curate then.
Always.
Yeah.
Always. And you know, if you're not, I have this thing where, you know, because I'm right about the market every single day, everyone expects me to be right, you know, every wiggle. And, you know, if you get it wrong, immediately everybody's yelling at you, you got it wrong. God, like, first of all, I don't know where you got the notion that I'm going to get it right 100% of the time. But in reality, I don't like to cull people who I've liked for a long time, and all of a sudden they're getting it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I've liked you for that long, you must be doing something right.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow or another, you're just out of sync with the market, and I understand it. Like, I'll give you an example. February 1st, the market was up really big. And all of a sudden, all these Twitter people who I really like were just dunking on Mike Wilson. I mean, and I said, my God, the guy has been the hottest hand for almost 2 years in the market. And he's missed this one move, and all of a sudden, he's terrible? My God, you miss one move in the market, and all of a sudden you're awful? I just don't agree with that.
Well, so that sentiment was probably fadeable.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, you know, like, I wouldn't all of a sudden ditch him because he's missed this move.
Got it. Is Mike Wilson someone who writes daily on the street or Twitter?
No. He's a Morgan Stanley strategist.
Got it.
And
he just came out a little conservative February 1 and
he's been bearish for a couple of months now.
Got it.
But last year, he called every single swing up and down perfectly.
Wow.
And now all of a sudden, now he's terrible. I'm like, he's not terrible. He's missed human. One move. He's human.
Well, it's great to see you're as passionate. Something else you're as passionate about is tennis. What has, you know, you were at the Australian Open. Was it fun? How hot was it?
Oh, Howard, it was so fun. But I have been to the Australian Open. This is my third time, and it is always brutally hot, like 100 mm-hmm. degrees. You're sitting there and you're dying.
Yeah.
And it was so cold this time, I can't even tell you. We had to buy sweatshirts and those big towels to use as blankets because it was 65 degrees and windy.
And Djokovic, is he the best of all time?
I think he's pretty darn good. Yeah. And I'm not a fan of his, but, you know, objectively, he's very good.
And who's your favorite? Is it Nadal or Federer?
It's always been Rafael Nadal because I saw him play at the 2004 Australian Open, and he was just a kid. Maybe he was 17, had never seen him before. And we watched him take a top 10 player to five sets, and my husband and I said, oh, God, he's just terrific. I've just been a fan ever since.
It's really what an era this was as a tennis fan. You didn't even my son to obviously Federer, Nadal, Djokovic.
Yeah.
The way they've dominated. It'll be hard to see that again. So tell me about pickleball. What do we think? There's a breakout chart. Okay. You're not playing, but do you get why it's hot? As someone who's looked at a lot of things and just a new trend?
I think it's hot because it's faster than tennis. It's almost like everybody's at the net playing really fast, mm-hmm. like doubles when everybody's at the net and you can hardly even watch the ball so fast. And also, I think because the court is so much smaller and everybody's at the net, I think it's attracted a lot of, I'll say, older people
mm-hmm.
who maybe can't cover the court so well on a tennis court anymore. And
well, it's also attracted people like my son, who was an okay tennis player. But I think the problem I've always had with tennis as a good player when I was young is you don't want to play with someone worse versus pickleball, which has perfect product market fit because you can hold a beer in your hand, you can play with a girlfriend. You can have a rally, may not be like a poignant rally, but you can have a rally with anybody.
Okay. You know, I don't play it. I've only seen it a little bit. But I will tell you, when I walked into the Australian Open grounds, they have sort of like all these games and such set up when you walk mm-hmm. into the grounds. And they had a pickleball court set up, and there were a lot of people playing.
And yeah, so they embraced it there. A lot of the clubs are not willing to embrace it yet because, you know, Village here, which is a big tennis club. And again, I've heard both sides of the argument. It's just, you know, there's the one side that's calling them purists. The other side that's saying, you know, we're a tennis club and you can't go get half pregnant here. You know, add one court, two courts. But I think the game is around to stay. I think it's the first game. I say this is kind of like the internet. It's kind of like perfect product market fit, you know, from young people to old people to the way it's accessible. It's kind of got perfect product market fit.
Well, I would tell you that I think those tennis clubs that are scoffing are going to start embracing it because from a financial perspective, you can get two pickleball courts where a tennis court is.
Yeah.
And think of the revenue.
Yeah. Comes down to the money, baby.
That CFO, even if it's a woman and it's conservative and risk averse, is going to go, hello, the pencil on the paper says pickleball.
And what sector in the market looks the most interesting to you from your work?
From the long side or the short side?
Yeah, from the long side.
Well, I've been focusing on industrials for the last week or two because they were the hottest group in the fourth quarter and mm-hmm. Or one of the hottest groups, you know, infrastructure, and everybody got all excited. But they have stalled out since like late November, December. And if they turn south from here, I think it's going to drag the rest of the market down.
So you think the industrials might have some hold some keys to the next move?
Right.
In the market.
Right now, all they've done is gone sideways. And so maybe they're just going sideways and they're consolidating, or they're just going to continue to chop and bore me to death, or they're going to break down. But if they break down, I think it portends, you know, further downside for stocks.
And what's the ticker on that? XLI?
XLI.
And what's an industrial company? Boeing?
Boeing, Deere, Cat.
Got it. All right, we're going to end it with that. What's the big plan on Valentine's Day for you? You take out three or four of your FinTwit fans?
No, I'm talking to you on Valentine's Day. That's my big excitement of the day.
Oh, my Lord. We need an intervention, Canute. I mean, at least pick Canute. So what are you going to do with your hubby tonight?
I don't know. I think I have some salmon in the fridge for dinner.
And then what is your recent favorite show that you guys have been watching? Anything you've binged on?
Have not. I'm a big book reader, and I just read Tunnel 29, which I thought was fabulous.
And what's that about?
It's about the Berlin Wall in the early 60s after it was built. And I didn't know how many tunnels were built for people to try and escape from east to west.
Makes sense.
And this was number 29 to give you an idea of how many were built.
Very interesting.
Yeah, it was really interesting.
I would assume most people going from east to west.
Yes, most people went from east to west, but this particular tunnel was built from the west to the east, which was what made it special. Yeah.
All right, so Tunnel 29, I've been watching this show, I don't know, Knut, if you watch it, called, and again, it's been canceled, but super interesting, because as a Jew, you know, we're fascinated by Nazis, unfortunately, but The Hunters on Amazon with Al Pacino.
Oh, I saw that a while back. Yeah, it was good.
It was good. It's a little weird and dark and fantasy-ish, but
yes.
As a Jew, it's hard to not watch Nazis getting killed. I will say that.
Have you finished it yet?
I have, and it didn't hold up, but
right.
You know, very
interesting. I was
going to
say it
take.
Fell apart at the end, yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely falling apart at the end. All right, well, we'll have you back, hopefully, to check in on the markets every 3 to 6 months. Hopefully, you enjoyed yourself.
I did. Thank you so much for having me.
Lovely to catch up. Keep St. Louis strong.
I'll do that.
And
play pickleball.
You know, when we do meet, we're just going to have to throw down a pickleball game.
Done.
Do you still playing tennis? Are you playing?
No, I had to give it up. I had a tennis elbow, and I said, I don't want to get back on it.
Well, then we won't play. We'll just eat.
That we can do.
All right. Have a great Valentine's Day, and we will talk to you soon.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. K-Nut.
Yes.
I grope, you grope. So a legend.
I love Helene.
There's not much going on in the market, so it's not. But I still felt like it was time to check in.
Right.
You know, when we checked in June, in hindsight, nailed it. Her and All-Star Charts.
Right.
It's amazing how, like, the professional technicians tune out the noise and just focus on price and how hard it is to do, but the best have an ability to, like, just look at the data and say, question your thinking. Very hard to do. I'm not good at it, but it's a skill that everybody has the ability to, you know, when you can follow Helene and you can follow someone like JC, All-Star Charts we have on all the time, what a gift to be able to just learn from the process. Anyways, you're listening to Panic with Friends. Thanks, Knut. We sit down with people like Helene and talk markets. We talk venture strategy, entrepreneurship, venture capital, trading. And we try and get a little ahead of the corner, build your peloton as such of 50 to 100 people that are worth following to keep you one step ahead of everybody else. You can find Panic with Friends and myself. Just search my name or Panic with Friends in Apple, Spotify, YouTube. Click subscribe. Makes it easy for you to get an alert each week with our new podcast. Thanks, Knut. See everybody next week.
Howard Lindzen is the founder and general partner at Social Leverage. All opinions expressed by Howard and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Social Leverage or StockTwits. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for decisions. Guests may maintain positions and securities discussed in this podcast.